Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Unseen Incidents. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straal, and on this week's episodes, we're looking at Manchester United. They are clearly better this season, but are they actually good? And do they have a decent shot at making the top four? Then we open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we ask about how players can decide which club they move to. We talk about the players we miss from the FD era. And we're bringing you some more nonsense than anything but football. That's all in this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So, Pete, we're back. I always am doing the intro and I'm kind of like, what are we doing for anything but football? And also we tend to have two or three options and I don't know which ones we'll get to or which ones we'll want to do at the time. So it's always like, and something and anything but football, some bullshit.
I'll be honest, I fully zoned out when you did it there. I have no idea what you actually said.
Yeah, but today you're zoning out, but you're looking directly at the camera. Like, are you trying not to look at yourself today? Or have you posted a picture of yourself over the camera?
I've got my notes over my portion of the screen.
What you should do is tape a picture of yourself over the camera, poke a hole in your own eye. so that you can actually look right at yourself while also giving me the illusion of eye contact. That'd be good.
I also think that would be slightly weird because I think post-COVID, in the world of video chat now, I don't think people are ready to be looked in the eye again. So you're looking at your screen now, but you're not looking directly in the camera.
I'm looking at you.
Yeah. But it feels different if you're staring at the camera it feels more performative.
Or it feels like when we were at school, sometimes to annoy a teacher, we would stare at their eyebrows.
Yeah, the forehead, yeah.
You know, where we just stare right at it and the teacher would be like, you need to look at me. And I am looking at you, sir. Like, it was just like that kind of thing. So yeah, I find this because when I record intros for the transfer flow, we'll shoot the episode. Yeah. And then at the end, I'll be like, right, let's intro it based on what we actually talked about.
Mm.
And then I look at the camera and I'm like, it looks like I'm looking above my laptop.
Yeah.
It looks stupid, but what are you going to do?
I find this with American sports broadcasting. I don't know if you noticed it, but the pre and post shows of American sports TV broadcasts, the pundits, they'll be having this conversation, but once each pundit will have their own section, say 45 seconds to say their piece. After the first 10 seconds of it throwing to them, they position themselves away from the conversation and start delivering their opinions directly down one of the cameras.
Yeah, that is weird,
even though it's within
it?
An actual conversation that's happening within the room. Whereas British broadcasters all just talk to each other and look at each other and the cameras are just there flying the wall style. And it's never sat right with me when I'm watching an American presenter kind of just it feels like they're force feeding me their opinion that should be just part of a conversation I'm not part of. It's a weird, I don't know if it's the subtle arrogance of the American that they feel that the viewer needs to be involved in every single facet of the conversation. But yeah, it's never sat right with me. And it's always made me, I've always just found it very strange that they're talking to me, like me individually.
It's kind of got a Fleabag energy. As in it's
breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah, breaking the fourth wall. They're having a conversation and they turn away and they'll be like, so, what did you think of our discussion here? And you're like, this makes me feel like I was spying on you rather than just a normal chat. Like it's totally fine. And also they slightly change their voice, right? So they'll be having a conversation and they're just like, ha, ha, oh, that's crazy. And then they turn to camera and they'll be like, so for more of some more of that coming up after the break when we go to, I don't know.
I wonder where you got that impression from.
Burnley to talk to some fucking cunt you don't know from Adam who's just scored a hat-trick for Burnley against Sunderland.
No, but that's different though, because that's an actual piece to camera, which I'm fine with. You're delivering that to the audience being okay, I'm now leading this from section A to section B. When you're in the middle of a conversation and you just turn away from the people you're actually conversing with to look at the camera, it just feels so weird and alien, and it's never sat right with me.
Fry and Laurie sketch where they're talking to each other and Stephen Fry is rambling on about language or something. And Hugh Laurie's kind of looking more and more confused, turns to the camera and goes, we're talking about language. It's kind of that thing. Or when somebody arrives late to a conversation And there are two of you, and then a third person arrives, and you kind of turn to them and you're like, do I now need to give you like a synopsis
of what's happened.
We are in the conversation? It kind of feels the same thing. You're like, for those of you who've just tuned in, tonight we're talking about how my friend is really, really tired at the moment because their job is so fucking hard. That's what we're talking about tonight. Yeah. The one thing that everybody wants to talk about.
Tiredness, yeah.
Everybody I know without children, they're like, whenever I see them, they're like, I'm just so tired at the moment. And I'm just like, I don't deny that you're tired. It's not like I don't think children without people without children can be tired, but know your audience. It was like one time my mother-in-law started telling me how annoying it is to have people misspell her name on things. And her surname is Cook with an E at the end. And she was like, they leave off the E at the end. And I was like, know your audience. Like, what's my name?
Yeah.
Like, I was like, my name is not the alphabet. Like, it is a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah. Wasn't there like a press article about Emma, who obviously has your surname, that was misspelled in a book run? I remember something when The Smacky Body came out.
Yeah, there was. And I told Emma, and Emma told her publicity team, and her publicity team contacted them, and they were like, you fucking sort us out. I'll fucking kill you. I'll never do business with you again, you fucking dumb fuck.
But I also get this.
And I was like, they were raising me, Pete. They were raising us, the white Dutchman.
Know your audience. I need to know my audience at home talking about tiredness, because obviously, like, I am with child, but Jess does by far and away the lion's share of
the lioness's care, share.
The lioness's share of, well, I don't see gender, Patrick. the 30% less share, pay share of the work, and particularly at night. And Bonnie is in the middle of either a massive sleep regression or teething. So we're kind of in the trenches at the minute. Mostly Jess, more than me. But yeah, she woke up at like 2:30 last night and screamed until 4. Because we're also trying to do sleep training as well. I think we're doing the chair method where you kind of sit and pat. We're trying to figure out a way.
And you gradually... are you going in and then you go out, or are you doing the gradual retreat from the room?
This is like day one, basically. Day one of trying to like figure it out, because she wouldn't settle unless she was basically put on the boob eventually, which we don't want that to establish that as being like the only way she'll ever settle.
Of course.
But yeah, so we were between like the Ferber method, which is like you leave a set amount of time before you go in and then you lengthen the time.
Yeah.
And then, but last
That's
night,
broadly what we did
last night, it was like Jess just sat in the room, and like I was in the next room, and none of us slept because like she was just screaming.
It's fucking maddening.
But yeah, Jess just kind of like sat right, but like down beside her, and just had an arm on her, and just like shushed and patted. And it was like after 45 minutes, she stopped and then started to settle, but would settle for like 2 minutes, and then like wake herself up again for the next 45 minutes. So yeah, hopefully it gets better tonight, and over the next week or so. But yeah, this is from having a baby who slept really well to not having a baby who's not sleeping well at all.
Sure.
Real shock to the system.
Yeah, but the benefit of this is that, like, in the first few months, when you get them to sleep, and that's great, but it's like the returns are only today, right? So, like, you get your child to sleep and they sleep now, and that's what you've accomplished. Whereas at least with sleep training, once it's done, like, there are like lasting benefits from it. Whereas like those first few months, you're like, if I get her to sleep tonight, there's no guarantee I'll get her to sleep tomorrow or like the day after.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing like that. Whereas at least with sleep training, you're like, once she self-soothes, we're kind of like home and hosed.
From the data set that we have available to us, so like the real life data set of our friends who have children, of the ones who sleep trained versus the ones who didn't sleep train, the ones who sleep trained overwhelmingly have better sleepers. They're like slightly older children who are 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. It's not just a coincidence.
Yeah. Also, whenever somebody says to me, Ted said this to me the other day, he was like, yeah, like my last child, she didn't sleep properly until she was like 3. And I was like, brother, that is a skill issue. Like, just sleep train that motherfucker. Like, just sleep train them. They can't cry all night for 3 years, you know? Isn't that a lesson that like the Stasi taught us or something? That like eventually they will succumb.
How long was the worst part of your sleep training journey?
Roughly? Coco's was like 2 weeks, I'd say. Coco's, I'd say, was a fairly solid 2 weeks of like pretty much on the hour, like every hour. Like she would kind of wake up, which also was annoying because like by that point I was back at work. So like there was a limit to, you know, as in I'd been off for 3 months and then I go back to work and literally like sleep regression hits immediately. Yeah. And so I was like, if this had happened a month ago, we could have actually shared this burden more, but we couldn't because I was fucking working. So there was a limit to how much I could help. So it's pretty rough on Emma. But yeah, like those 2 weeks were bad. And then after that, we had like some brief times where we had to do it again. You know, like not the whole thing, but as in like
kind of she'd reinforce wake up. It.
I remember periods, for example, there's like a 2 week period that feels like it's forever, but there's like a 2 week period for her when she was like 11 months or something where she was just waking up at 4:30. And then we had to kind of adjust her naps and stuff or like do a little bit of the training again. But basically,
like waking up for the day at 4:30 or just randomly waking up?
She would randomly wake up. Like we could get her back to sleep, but it was, but yeah,
that's
it was
a lot
like
more manageable though.
On the dot. And you're like, that's pretty fucking exhausting. But yeah, like, because we already had the pattern and because she was sleeping through most of the night, it was okay. And also you do adjust the naps and stuff, right? But yeah. But those 2 weeks were, you know, those intensive driving courses where they teach you to drive in a week. I was like, that does the like basically everything that needs to be done. And then like, you know, it doesn't mean you're never going to get into trouble on the road, but basically like that fixes it.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel we're on day two of that.
Yeah. It'll feel like it lasts forever, but then she'll get it. And like, she's a little sweetie.
Yeah.
You know, some people have to do this and their kids are ugly.
I know. It was one of my biggest fears that Bonnie would come out ugly.
Man, fair enough. Like completely reasonable. Or a boy. Right
now. No, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with the boy. It just,
I wouldn't have loved a boy.
It's the aesthetic needs to be appropriate.
No, I agree. Yeah, like sometimes I, you know, I say this to people all the time. I said this to a friend of mine the other day when she was like talking about her kids. I was like, but do you not look around at other people's kids and you think like she's one of the few people I know who has two and both of them are like really cute. I was just like, man, most people get at least one Argo, like one write off. Yeah, and then the other ones, like, you know, like as in when you're dealing in poker and you just burn one, you're like, okay, burn that one, deal that one. is this acceptable shit to say?
Yeah, they're hypothetical children. I think it's fine.
They're not. They're children I know. Emma had to tell me off today because she was just like, please stop saying this, because I was talking about some kid at Coco's school and I was just like, yeah, well, it sounds like he's making bad choices and he's a little cunt. I was trying not to call him a little cunt, but I was just like, Coco could kind of spell now, so we're in trouble.
Oh, really?
she's learning to, so I was just like, I can't really, maybe if I say the real letters rather than like
you're not like spelling it out for you.
But some little kid, like, it doesn't matter, it's a long story, but I was just like, I guess I've got a blood feud with his stupid family now, and every time I see his mum she gives me a half smile, I fucking blank her because her kid's a psycho in my opinion.
Interesting.
But he's a boy, what'd you expect? Scum. No, look, I actually love, like, basic all the little boys I know are really like fun and affectionate, but you and I needed three girls between us to like kick things off at least.
Well, I mean, to fulfill the potentially one of the greatest jokes that somebody's ever told me was the when you gave them the name the microplastics, it just wouldn't have worked with a boy. If one of the first three was a boy, it just wouldn't have worked.
Whose joke was that? I thought that was yours.
No, it was your joke.
It can't have been mine.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll take credit, sure. Yeah, good one,
you,
me.
I remember you told me, you then gave me like a play-by-play of being in the room as you thought of it, because you leaned over to Emma and just thought, and like chuckled, and as you typed it out, and like...
Oh, that's so fucking stupid.
Showed it to her as you sent it, being like, I've just made a really funny joke.
Oh my God, Jesus.
Yeah.
What? Honestly, I must be so annoying to be married to. Like, fucking hell. All right. Let's get into our topic for today then, because we're talking about Manchester United, and like it felt quite interesting because, you know, the top four race as well is going to be a part of this conversation. Like, we're not going to touch on all those teams. United are the one we're going to focus on, but the top four race is really, really open right now. Like, we are looking at a league table in which I would say there's one like categorically really good team. I expect that by the end of the season, there will be more than one. But right now, there's one. I would argue that after that, you know, like the top three looks very normal. But like when you look at expected goal difference,
Then you get Arsenal, City, Palace, Liverpool, and Brighton, Chelsea, Newcastle are very, very close behind Liverpool. City also, I mean, like, City do look like at least the second best team in the league, but they also don't quite look like Man City, and they've got Liverpool next weekend, and then they've got Newcastle away the week after that. So that's an opportunity for these teams around them to catch up to them. Like, City coming up to second has partially been the product of having a really easy run of fixtures recently, pretty much ending with Bournemouth home, right? Like, that was the time when it was starting to get hard. So when I look at this table now, I'm like, man, Chelsea are in 7th. Newcastle are in 13th. And I think Newcastle are pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Villa are in 11th. I think they suck. Tottenham are in 6th. I think they suck.
They suck.
Like, so it really does feel like everything's kind of up for grabs. And the underlying numbers at this point, after 10 games of the season, basically, when we talk about, like, expected goals and stuff, generally speaking, at the beginning of the season, so, like, after 10 games, expected goals are a better predictor of future success than real goals. And as the season goes on, real goals become a better predictor. But it happens gradually. So by the end of the season, by, like, match week 37, you know, like, real goals and real goal difference become a pretty good predictor of how good the teams are. But this is why you might see people producing prediction models over the course of the season where they're like, this is 70% XG, 30% real goals, for example. And that gradually shifts. Right now, expected goals is the best tool we have. And right now, expected goals suggests that Liverpool are okay, but, like, some way off Palace, a long way off City, and a really long way off Arsenal. And it puts Brighton right there with them, and Chelsea right there with them, and Newcastle right there with them. Now, behind those teams is Manchester United. And that's, you know, that's a step forward for United, right? Like, they're behind this pack of 7.
I mean, they're like a step backwards would have been the Championship.
Sure, that's a reasonable point. No, it wouldn't. It would have been to where Spurs been like, finished. It would have been, yeah, been where Spurs finished.
17th.
But, like, United, look, United right now are, they have a positive goal difference of 1. They have positive expected goal difference of +2. The attack, though, in particular, is kind of good, question mark?
I mean, it's better, like, than it was.
By expected goals, it's third best in the league.
Yeah.
I don't think the schedule's been, like, great. The schedule's firmed up, actually, recently, hasn't it? The defence, not so good. But, like, I would say that this is a significant step forward on last season. And I don't think it's just, like, we plugged a couple of good players into it and it got better. Like, I do think there are signs of of course it is, but at the same time, Cunha's missed a load of minutes, and Mbeumo's been playing, but only recently started actually converting production into goals and assists, right? The midfield is still, in my opinion, fucking shocking. As in, Bruno's great, but, like, he's not a central midfielder.
Yeah, yeah.
Casemiro is 1,000 years old.
And Ugarte,
everyone just, like, pretends doesn't exist now, which is kind of funny. But United, I think, since that Brentford loss, they've beaten Sunderland, they've beaten Liverpool away, they've beaten Brighton at home, which I think is a particularly interesting result, and they've drawn away with Forest. And these are results and performances that I think broadly speak to a side that is upper mid-table on the cusp of the European spots. Like, that's kind of where I think they are. So, Pete, like, with that kind of, like, I guess, like, basic run-through in mind, like, where do you want to start this today? Like, what feels like a good spot for you?
So I think in your intro there, you kind of said that a lot of this is up for grabs. And I do agree with a lot of that. But also I feel like there's not a huge amount up for grabs at the same time. I think there's a lot of teams that could grab things, but I don't think it's a huge amount to grab, because I feel come the end of the season, I think the top three positions will be pretty nailed on. Even though Liverpool are a little bit dodgy, I thought they looked pretty good last night against Real Madrid. I think over the course of a season, Liverpool, City and Arsenal will break away from the rest of the pack.
I agree, but that still leaves probably 2 spots.
1 or 2, depending on how...
Potentially 2, though.
Yeah, but then you start to ask yourself, and the question we're kind of angling in towards here, in a kind of United-centric way, is, are United good enough, or what are their chances at finishing Champions League? And United are better than they were last season. They, like you say, they're 8th at the minute, but they are, what, 3rd for expected goals. They're just 2, and the thing is, they're just 2 points off City as well, right? So they're sitting in 8th, but they're 2 points off City in 2nd. And that feels like a big jump forward. from where they were last season, even where they were early this season. This season was a bit funny. United took 7 points from the first six games, one win after five games in the league, and also lost to Grimsby in the League Cup. And at that time, it kind of felt like Amorim might be circling the drain. You know, maybe it can't get much worse than this for Amorim to...
When that image was going round of him like fiddling with the tactics board.
Oh, the magnetic board, yeah.
I think we all expected that to be like the like Ruud Gullit in the rain. Like that's the abiding image of him just before he got the sack.
It really did feel like the end was coming. Like the end was nigh at the very, very start of the season. And they found themselves, what, like 17th, 16th or something at that stage. After that, they went on, won four games out of the next five. They've won 4-6 now, but with a draw, I think. They're up to 8th, but 2 points off 2nd. So, like, it's all trending in the right way. But there are United fans, and also the narrative kind of seems to shift. And I think people need to kind of pump the brakes a little bit in saying that, okay, United are going to finish in Champions League, or United have a really good chance of finishing in Champions League. Because when you look at how congested that table is and the teams that they have to finish above, that's when it starts getting quite difficult for a team like United. Because United can be better than they were last season and still be a big stretch off what they need to be to finish Champions League. There's a huge gap in between where they were last season and what the level the team finishes fourth this season will be. And while United are in touching distance with City, they're actually quite a far bit back. So if you look at their expected goal difference per 90, United are plus 0.2, which is fairly average. It's positive, which is always good. But City are at plus 0.8. They're 2 points ahead, but massively ahead in a lot of their underlying numbers. Liverpool are plus 0.5. So when you look at how good United have been so far, how much better United have been than they were at the start of the season, I do think you need to take it with a pinch of salt and kind of pump the brakes a little bit, because yes, they are better, but it's not difficult to be much better than you were last season when you were as bad as United were last season. And two, in order to finish fourth, maybe fifth, and get Champions League spot, there are teams like Bournemouth, Spurs are kind of crap, Chelsea, Palace, Brighton, who am I forgetting? Newcastle's here, I'm forgetting. Loads of teams that you need to finish above, and B teams who are better positioned.
But when you look at those teams, you're like, okay, Chelsea, okay, Liverpool are on plus, when you say they're on plus 0.5, they're on plus 0.46, which is like not a huge difference, but it is a bit of a difference, because like Chelsea are on plus 0.38, all right? So if Chelsea in their next game have a negative 1xG difference, right? They get beaten on XG in inverted commas, like 2-1, and United have a positive XG difference in their next game of 1, then like suddenly that gap is gone. Like that's how quickly that gap can change at this stage of the season.
Yeah, but when you look at United, while they're one of the highest teams in the league for expected goals, they're also one of the highest teams for expected goals against.
I don't disagree.
One and a half goals on average so far this season in the Premier League conceded per 90. They are 15.5 expected goals against in 10 games.
It's quite bad.
The only teams that are worse than them, Burnley and someone else.
Like Burnley and Forest are worse than them.
They've got a worse expected goals against than West Ham do.
They've conceded more expected goals than like Arsenal and City put together.
Yes.
Which is a lot. I would say that is a lot.
There's only been two instances this season in the 10 games where United have conceded under one expected goal against in a game. Chelsea, for example, while they're kind of in touching distance, expected goal difference per 90-wise, Chelsea have done that 4 times in 10 games, and they've also done it in the Champions League. So there is still underlying numbers showing that there is a gap between United, who are vying, so theoretically vying, for a Champions League spot, and the team, in my opinion, Chelsea, who is far and away the most likely to finish in fourth.
Sure.
And that doesn't mean United aren't better. It doesn't mean United aren't approaching towards a decent team. It doesn't mean United don't have a chance to finish in those positions. They could do. But what we've seen from United has been a shift in... What's promising is that Amorim was flirting with like Ange levels of stubbornness tactically to a fault, and to a point where you think, okay, if he just keeps flogging this dead horse and doesn't adapt, doesn't concede something, this is not going to end well. Ange has done that at two clubs now and got the sack.
I mean, that is still kind of true. As in like...
With Amorim.
Yeah.
Because I think like, he has made shifts this season. That's some concessions or evolution.
He is unwilling to change like certain aspects of the way he plays. Like he does still, he's always going to play 3-4-3.
Yes.
He is always going to, we're going to come on to tactical stuff, but he's always going to be like kind of cross heavy, like kind of attack, reasonably direct attack as well, I think. Yeah. High line. Like there are things there where he's like quite stubborn, I think. But yeah, I'm not saying he hasn't changed anything tactically, but like there were times I think where he could have just like moved away from the 3-4-3 and that might have been smart. and he just didn't want to.
I fully agree, but I think the longer we get into this project, the more capable the squad will be, either in personnel or just experience under Amorim, to implement what he wants to implement. I think the issues of him being so stubborn was in the very, very early days, when he had a squad totally ill-equipped to kind of do the things he was trying to do. Also trying to do the things he did in Portugal, where, okay, it's quite, maybe not easy, but it's a lot easier to do what he does, play the way he wants to play in Portugal when you're a massively dominant team in a inherently uneven league. Much more difficult to do that in the Premier League at a team who is as middling as United have been for the last decade, and where the quality across the entire board from first through to basically 18th every season.
Yeah.
Is, you know, you might get one or two dead rubber teams, but basically the overwhelming majority of the league is a very decent team at worst, or enough to kind of really pick apart a bad or ill-equipped system. So I think, yeah, he could still fall on his own sword in the sense that like he's so stubborn that it just becomes untenable at some stage. But we have already seen progressions this season. They look better on the pitch, underlying numbers are better, and there have been tactical shifts. So like I guess we can look at what is different to say the Amorim of last season to the Amorim of this season. And one of them, I think, is I think time's always beneficial in this, in when you're trying to shift systems. Loads of the players have just played more minutes under him. He's had another transfer window, he's brought in players. Like all of that just helps the system click a little bit better, and the new additions will help that too, because he's kind of bringing in players who he feels fit to systems. Lamine coming in after Onana didn't work out. We can get onto Lamine in a little bit, but that helps. And Wemo and Cunha, I don't like the signings long term, but they are two good Premier League players coming off very good seasons. They are going to make United better in the short term, just dropping them in that team. We've seen that, particularly with Mbeumo recently, not so much with Cunha, but Mbeumo has come in and really helped shift some of the like attacking output reliance from Bruno. He's helped kind of shoulder a lot of that burden. Last season, Bruno was the only United player who had over half an expected goal involvement per 90 of anybody who played over 1,000 minutes. And Joshua Zirkzee was the only player with more XG per 90, and Eriksen was the only player with more expected assists per 90. Both of them played less than half the minutes than Bruno did. Like they both of them just about qualify north of 1,000 minutes as a cutoff point. So basically for most of the season, Bruno was like out in his home doing all of the creation and all of the kind of a lot of the goal scoring for United, as he's been used to. But this season, Bruno's up at 0.67 expected goal involvements per 90, but Mbeumo's like up there too,
crazy,
at 0.57. And Mbeumo's over 0.3 expected goals per 90 and about 0.25 expected assists per 90. So Bruno has the most expected goals per 90 in the squad, and Mbeumo's second. And Mbeumo's got the most expected assists per 90 in the squad, and Bruno second. So they're kind of sharing. Bruno at least has somebody to help him. And then you have Amadeo, who's like third or fourth in both of those metrics. So Bruno's continued to be great, but you've added a really dangerous like inside right asset, and you have a super exciting overlapping or underlapping right wing back in Amad. So when you look at like the positions of dominance United have had this season, outside of the kind of roles, the positions where you expect your centre-backs to be on the ball a lot, the only positions on Opta's pitch maps where United are dominant is the entire right flank. The three quadrants in the entire right flank, which isn't surprising when you see the players there and the way they're playing. So I think getting extra bodies in there that are good, proven Premier League players, and also just kind of developing Amad a bit more, and bringing in someone who can actually help score and create outside of just Bruno will put you in a better position. That's where United are. That's not like a seismic change, but the more you do that, that will help. But say you do that on the left wing, and say you do that in midfield, the way Amorim's playing, that won't mean that pitch chart of dominance will suddenly start having like big United blocks all over it, because the way Amorim's playing is quite a bit different to how he played last season. And in short, basically, he's going far longer and far more direct than he was last season.
Yeah.
So last season, and even back to Ten Hag, we saw United trying to play out from the back and making an absolute mess of it. And mainly that was because they were playing in from centre-backs into centre midfield to a player like Eriksen on the edge of his box facing his own goal and getting dispossessed or taking a bad touch or taking a bad pass. A player who previously was good but is not a deep-lying six, taking the ball in high congested areas and kind of breaking out of a press that way. That was never going to end well. And as a result, like last season, United had the highest number of touches in their defensive third of anyone in the league, but they also were turning over the ball 5.5 times a game in their defensive third, beaten only by Spurs and a horrible Southampton team. Bear in mind, Spurs were like absolutely reckless at points under Ange.
Yeah.
So that is a really, really miserable table to be kind of topping or up at the top end of. This season, however, only Arsenal have fewer touches than their defensive third than United do. And United's turnovers in that area have dropped 56%. They're 2.4. Again, second only to Arsenal. But that's not because United have suddenly gotten really good at playing in the midfield and not turning the ball over in those high congested like midfield six roles. It's because they're just kind of entirely skipping it out now and they're going over the top. Because they've realised, sensibly, we do not have the personnel in there to be firing balls in and getting beneficial outcomes that don't hurt us in the long run. And we've seen that with Lamens come in, the proportion of like long balls launched by goalkeepers gone like skyrocketed. We've seen United's attack go from quite a slow and a bit laboured to much quicker. United were the fifth slowest attack last year to the eighth fastest attack so far this season. Their passes per possession are down 15%. Their 10 plus pass sequences down 30% on last season. United are just going longer and quicker and skipping out a lot of the middle part, which again comes with its own limitations, comes with its own issues, but they're immediately kind of not solving, but they're just skipping one of the biggest issues they saw last season, was that they were trying to do something, they were really steadfast in this, but they just didn't have the personnel either as a skill set or just quality to do that. And we saw time and time again, United just couldn't progress the ball. When they got the ball in the midfield, they would turn it over and they just made life difficult for themselves. So we're seeing shifts positive in that sense that like Amorim is making concessions to how he might not ideally want to play, but knows that it's better for the squad based on who he has at the minute.
I also think it like makes more sense for where the league is. Like,
I agree.
The league now has like so many teams that will press high competently, and United were just getting blown up on these again and again and giving up big chances. Now, this is not to say they've stopped giving up big chances. They definitely still are doing that. But like the league now is much more like that. This season, there's a lot of kind of kick and run, you know, like teams kind of like hitting long balls into the channels, trying to win headers or at least trying to win second balls. And I mean, and I think broadly it's like a reasonable strategy. So like I got a lot of pushback on Twitter because like during the Liverpool game, I was like, I don't know if this is working. Because they got a chance early on, they went one up, and then it just felt like the long balls were giving the ball back to Liverpool again and again.
Yeah.
Like, because the centre-backs were winning it. Then they just give it to Gravenberg, and he was just running through the midfield because, like, nobody in the United midfield can defend. And I think when those long balls are straight like that, I think you're asking for trouble because most teams can come back and just punch through the middle of you, and you can't cough up possession that much in the Premier League.
United did get trouble in that game though because they conceded twice the amount of expected goals to Liverpool than they put up, and they also had 35% possession. Like that did come back down them. United got lucky to not concede more in that game.
Well, also I just felt like everybody remembered at the end of the first half the periods when it worked, which were like the kind of 10-15 minutes at the beginning and the 10 minutes at the end of the half. And in between, there was like a 20-minute period where they were under constant pressure and they were sinking really, really deep. And it was because every time they got the ball, they'd kick long.
And
I got people saying like, United have won every second ball this first half. And I was like, have I been imagining seeing Ryan Gravenberch like walk through your midfield again and again? And like, I think those very straight long balls against big centre-backs are a bad idea. But big long balls aimed at the full-backs, that makes more sense. And switches, you know, like United are third in the league for switches.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense, right? Because you've got numbers out wide. You've always got the right winger.
Particularly on the right,
an inverted winger. You've got the right wing-back. And you've even got a midfielder and a right-sided centre-back who can push out there as well. Like you've got loads of numbers there. And this is something that everybody's always done. Like Pep used to do this, which was like, we drag you over to one side, and then we switch quickly over to the other side. Like, that's a normal thing to do. And it's especially helpful in United's case because they've got good players, but they don't have great dribblers or carriers with the exception of Amad. So they're mid-table in the league for progressive carries. They're fifth bottom for dribbles attempted, but they're fifth in the league for carries into the penalty area. So they're getting lots of carries into the penalty area without people having to beat their man to do it. Well, how are they doing that? It's because United are finding them in space. So I think from that point of view, it's really good. And that gives them those kind of free carries into dangerous zones. So I don't think you want to do that. But yeah, I agree that like you definitely want to alleviate this receiving play building burden on the midfielders who are all terrible at it. Like not a single one of them could do it. Like Bruno can do final third play, but he can't do play building from deep. Casemiro can't do anything. Mainoo can't do anything. Ugarte can't do anything.
Mainoo's a good ball carrier, but you don't
want him. Not in the Premier League, isn't.
Compared to the stable of United centre back, centre mids, he's a good ball carrier.
I don't know if he is, man. Like, I just think he's too slow and too weak.
You don't want him carrying the ball through those areas because he's not good enough to do it, but he is still a decent ball. You know what I mean?
And that's also like a risk tolerance that United simply don't have, because the other part of this, I imagine, let's come on to defence in a minute, but like, because the other part of it is the defence. And that's one reason you don't want Mainoo carrying, I think, because it opens you to real disaster.
You want a player who passes out of there, because passing is just safer. If you're a really good passer, you can manipulate a press much easier than taking the ball in or around contact.
Yeah, and United need this guy. Like, United need their Zubimendi. They need their Wharton. Like, Wharton would be perfect for them. Like what they need is that guy who gets the ball from the centre-backs, receives under pressure, turns, plays forward, or, if United are winning, controls the tempo. And, like, this is why Ten Hag was using Eriksen there.
Jorginho was prime.
Yeah, or, like, this is why that you had to use Eriksen there. Because Eriksen was the only guy with Ten Hag where he was like, that's the only guy who's got the brain to do this. It's this guy who is technically dead. Like, he's a guy who could do this. Everybody else can't do it.
Previously dead.
Formerly dead.
yeah.
But, like, having that player would mean they could play out a bit more. They could control tempo. Mm-hmm. It would mean they didn't have to go wide. And I do think that going wide as well is sometimes bullshit progression. Like, I think about Arsenal last season, and Arsenal would get up the pitch really quickly, because they would just carry the ball out wide. And a lot of teams in the Premier League are like, fill your boots, mate. Like, carry out wide.
You're going to get stuck out there and then...
Exactly,
we don't give a fuck.
Like, go ahead. And also, in the time that you're carrying there, you're not really carrying at speed. So by the time you carry the ball out there, and we even see it now, like Mbeumo will pick the ball up, come deep, pick the ball up, turn, run wide.
Yeah.
And in the time he's doing that, all the other team's defenders run back to the actual zone they need to defend.
Like, in the middle. If you're carrying or progressing the ball into an area of the pitch where the defense is shepherding you into, who's really winning in that scenario?
Exactly. So I think there's some of that progression, which I think maybe like United would be better off rejecting. You know, like saying, we're not actually going to turn and go into those zones where we get stuck, because... For one, I think United are at their best when they can bait the press. Like, when the press comes onto them and they can go over, that's better for them. They're not very good in that final third. And I think that's where we kind of come onto the defence, which is that, like, United, when they get into the final third, are putting themselves in danger a lot of the time, because the defensive line's really, really high. It's the fourth highest line in the league, but they're mid-table for PPDA. So it's like they lose the ball... There's no pressure on the ball, and the line's really high with, I think we'd agree, like pretty slow defenders. So they are vulnerable for quick goals in behind. And you think about like City's third goal against them. Ball breaks, United semi win it back, but Maguire gives it away. Easy pass in behind. Haaland literally is running from inside his own half to go and like score that goal. And this happens a lot. And like Hayden, who I work with at Transfer Flow, like he works with Skill Corner. And they have like this stuff where they talk about like percentage of finish and stuff. So it's like basically like they look at teams' effectiveness in different phases. And so when they're in the final phase, so they're in the final third, they're like trying to actually construct an attack. United give the ball away in that final phase of play. I think they were 19th in the league. I think they were like second worst in the league for giving the ball away there. And I think this is one of the reasons why the shots they give up are the most dangerous in the league. Like, United's defensive thing, like, if you look at United and Palace, those two defenses, and, like, Palace are often compared to them, right, because of the setup. Like, they're giving up very similar numbers of shots, 11.2 to 11.8, but Palace have given up 12 XG through 10 games, which is not great, by the way, but like they've given up 12 XG through 10 games, and United have given up 15.5. And the entire difference between them is not in number of shots, but it's in shot quality. It's just that the chances they concede are so bad. And to me, that's because you can fucking counter on United. So with Amorim, like I've just got a bit of a question mark because I think it took him so long to get to this point. I am a bit concerned that when teams are like, oh, well, this is how United play, and they adapt to it, like maybe they let United have the ball and United come out at them a bit more. And they're like, right, United are going to carry into the wide areas.
Yeah.
And then we're just going to fucking like spring attacks on them. Like, and it's fine. Like once they start doing that, my worry is then does Amorim have a plan for the next stage of this? Right. You know, like it would be the way that I was thinking about Arsenal set pieces recently. And it was like a load of teams seem to go into games with Arsenal, like literally not having a plan for dealing with set pieces. They're like, we hope our guys win the headers. And it's like, yeah, but Arsenal have a plan.
Yeah.
To win the header.
Do you have a plan? Do it so well as well.
And do you have a plan to win the header, to not allow their players to get free? Or is it just like, our plan is our guy will be better in the air than their guy? Like,
we're just going to want it more.
And also, of course, the attacking team, right, get a run up. The defending team is just standing still. Like, it does. Like, I was like, this doesn't work. Like, you have to have a plan. And I thought, you know what's fucking ridiculous is that I see Arsenal score the same set piece goal like every week. It's not even a variation. They basically have two different ones they've scored this season. And I thought, what would be interesting is, if teams come up with a plan to deal with those, do Arsenal have more variations to go through? And they might do. Arsenal might be like, oh yeah, we've got another plan and we've got another plan. We've got plans B and C and D and E. You'd imagine they do. But we might never know because plan A and B work every single week. And so similarly here, I'm like, right, okay. Amorim has now worked out a plan B and it's not working perfectly, but it's working well enough. And it'll work well enough probably that they can get through the year and buy some central midfielders. You know, if that happens and they finish the year like seventh and they're in the Europa or whatever, and or whatever they'd be in the Conference League, and they like go and fucking like get like two central midfielders, I'd be like, great, man. Like, cool. Okay. Now we're kind of cooking. But my worry is that like teams in the Premier League, because the Premier League is full of really fucking smart managers and really skilled teams, will be like, okay, we've worked out what United are doing effectively against us now. We've also worked out that they're incredibly vulnerable to these fast attacks. We are now going to play to maximise the danger to them on those attacks. And then Amorim will be like, oh, fuck, like, what do I do now? And we might get another round of, like, United not being able to work it out. Like, that's kind of my concern, because I feel like over this last... however long it's been that Amorim's been in charge. What, a year now?
Just over.
Like, I do feel like he's been extremely slow to fix anything.
Yeah, but he's still figuring it out. Like, he's still new in the role. Well, I guess it's been long enough.
He's not new as a manager. Like, yeah. I mean, like, he could try different... Like, what we're talking about here, Pete, like not... I don't want to, like, completely shit on it, but, like...
Yes, you do. You absolutely do.
United are playing long balls. Like, yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing it took him a year to work out. He was just like, shit, short build-up isn't working. What can we do? Long ball? Long ball? It's just like, Sam Allardyce would have worked that out in 30 seconds.
It reminds me of the long ball. The Van Gaal era, where the plan B tactic was just stick Marouane Fellaini at centre-forward and fucking pepper balls up to him.
In fairness... did it not work? Like, you know, I saw some disgruntled Arsenal fan like yesterday or something being like, Jesus Christ, like every time that we've got like an injury crisis, Arteta just like does the most boring thing and sticks Mikel Merino up top. And I was like, Mikel Merino scored two goals. Like, this motherfucker can't stop scoring when we play him up front. I was like, you know what? Like, Will's, it's the same way that like I make the same jokes at Emma's expense again and again. And I'm just like, I'll stop making it when you stop laughing at it. You know, like...
or when it stops being funny.
We will stop playing Fellaini up front when you have a plan for dealing with Fellaini up front. but United, like, I think Cunha's looked really good. I think Abermo's looked pretty good. I think Šeško's looked okay. I think he looks... He definitely looks raw, but he doesn't look...
Yeah.
He doesn't look
He's been underwhelming.
I think that we talked about our reservations on him. And I think he looks like where we expect him to be. I don't think he looks any worse. And I don't think he looks any better. But there are moments, actually, where he's receiving the ball with his back to goal and doing, like, conventional striker stuff. And we were kind of like, I don't know if he can do that. If he can do that, then, like, you've got a pretty exciting prospect there.
One of the, I guess, limitations of United and how long this roadmap is to being, like, a genuine Champions League team again, a lot of that kind of depends, or a large portion of that depends on how long it takes Šeško to kind of evolve into the player that United hope he will be. Because, yeah, he's been raw. I guess I'm probably a little bit more underwhelmed than you seem to be, but his numbers aren't fantastic. 0.3 non-expected goals per 90, bottom of the 40th percentile for forwards. He's only getting 3 touches in the opposition box per 90, bottom 10%. Receiving 3 progressive passes, bottom 3rd. Yeah, it's numbers that I'd like to be higher, but he is super young and has just been dropped into kind of a bit of a shit show at United.
His shot numbers, man, he's at like 2.8 shots per 90 as a 22-year-old.
He's got 2 goals from 2 people next year across 600 league minutes. Not terrible.
It's not terrible. Like, his shot quality is okay. His shot volume is straight up good. And, like, you know, you look at his shot volume and you're like, oh, well, you know, he's not getting many touches in the box though. And then I look at someone like Gyökeres and I'm like, okay, well, Gyökeres is at 2.1 shots per 90, significantly worse. But on the other hand, he's at, like, I don't know, he's at 6.4 touches in the box, so more than twice as many as Šeško. Well, which way round do you want it? Like, I truly don't know. Like, I mean, like, Gyökeres is getting enough touches in the box that I'm like, I assume the shots will come at some point. But Šeško's getting the shots on a team that isn't really functioning. I feel pretty good about that. Like, I don't think that's bad.
Well, what are shots per 90?
Šeško, 2.8.
So he's getting basically 3 shots from 3 touches in the box per 90.
Yeah, yeah. So and so his shot quality is 0.13. So it's not even, like, bad. That's it's good. A little bit above average. And you're like, well, he's getting, like Gyökeres is at 3/4 of Šeško's shot volume. Well, okay, Arsenal's attack isn't really functioning right now, and United kind of feel like they're going all out to try and maximise the attack.
Yeah,
so
and
look,
Bruno's like just...
And you also look at Arsenal and you're like, okay, Ødegaard comes back, and suddenly you've got, like, Saka, Eze, Ødegaard, who are all creators behind Gyökeres. Like, if that doesn't get him scoring goals, nothing will. But my point is only that, like, for Šeško as a 22-year-old who didn't really get a preseason with the team, who we had reservations about, especially about shot volume, and he's already getting okay shot volume, and I think he's shown moments of decent link-up, and we know his physical abilities. I look at that and I'm like, is this, like, should United have paid 90-odd mil for him? Probably not. But, like, I think the prospects are fairly decent that he turns into a good striker. Like, I see United fans already comparing him to Højlund, and I'm kind of like, man, Højlund wasn't platformed correctly in that United team, but I'm already seeing, I feel better, a better fit in Šeško than I did in Højlund.
Yeah, I think the issue here isn't Šeško turning into a good player. The issue is how long that takes, because he is United's 9.
What, as in he needs to get good before Cunha and Mbeumo drop off?
And if the angle here is United being a Champions League team, yeah, it's the time it takes between Šeško from now to being like a good Premier League version of Šeško, and the time it takes Mbeumo and Cunha and Bruno Fernandes to go from where they are now to being a significantly less efficient or impactful version of what they are now in the Premier League. That's the cross section. That's a Venn diagram of how fruitful this whole endeavour will be used for United in terms of becoming a better Premier League team.
Agreed. I think that's fair. So with all this in mind, everything that we've talked about, where are you on their prospects for the future and for the season?
I think for the season, like, they're going to finish somewhere between 6th and 8th. I think that's a good... I mean, 6th quite high, actually. Somewhere between 7th and 9th, I would say. I don't really see...
I think sixth with a fair wind is possible, not likely, but it's possible.
I think seventh or eighth is probably the most likely position to finish.
I think so.
I think when you look at the team... So it's less about how good United can be versus how good the other teams around them can be and the teams that they need to beat. So, like, I think Newcastle are a pretty decent team who have just got a pretty horrible run of luck. They have a similar expected goal difference per 90 to Chelsea. They got the second best defense in the league by expected goals against.
They've had some horrendous injuries.
Fourth for expected points by understat. And they're currently sitting in what, like 13th?
13th.
Yeah, so I think they will come back into contention reasonably quickly, but they're also starting from 5 points back. So that is a little bit of a leveler at this stage. We've got 28 games a season left, but it's still, they're starting essentially on negative five to where the likes of Chelsea, United and stuff are. I think Palace will probably cool off a little bit. They'll end up somewhere around United, somewhere in Europa League positions. Bournemouth will do the same. I think they bled a lot in the summer. Barney, Houston, Kirkes, Utara. They've already got a couple of injuries at centre forward. They've got pretty thin up there. They're not overly stacked on like left-sided attackers. I can see them cooling off a fair bit across the full season, so they'll end up kind of in and around the same area that United will be vying for Europa League / Conference League positions. And then I feel that like Chelsea are just going to stretch away. Like Chelsea are basically just, if you look at most of their underlying numbers, in and around fourth best team in the league.
And they've got Palmer to come back.
Yeah, it's like I just don't see, like if you look at the supercomputer's probability, you've got the big three teams, up at 70% chance of finishing in Champions League spot. Then a huge drop to 40% Chelsea. Then another big drop to 25% for everybody else and below. And I kind of think if we're talking just straight up Champions League spots, the interesting thing will be fifth. But I think fourth will just be Chelsea. And then you've got a real kind of dogfight between the other three, four teams for fifth through ninth.
Yeah, and Palace have the best numbers at the moment. And Bournemouth look really good as well, but I'm sort of inclined to think Newcastle will end up making it, just because I think
Newcastle
are where they are in the numbers, at least, despite starting the season without a centre-forward and blooding Voltomada now. This has been out all season, like literally hasn't played. Might not make his debut until after AFCON. Lewis Hall, who's a really key player for them, been out as well. Like they've had real Livramento, like... They've had genuinely like a lot of problems, and yet their numbers still look good. The defense looks fucking great. Like I kind of feel like they'll just be totally fine.
They're fourth for expected points for understat.
Yeah, part of the thing with them and Chelsea is they just have a better squad than the teams they're up against. Like I look at United and I think, yeah, like the only player to come back who can really make a difference to this team is Lisandro Martinez.
Yeah. He'll get like injured immediately again.
That would help a lot, but like, you know, I just don't believe it anymore. Whereas Chelsea, I'm like, oh yeah, Palmer. Palmer's just going to play for Chelsea at some point and be amazing. And then you're going to have two of the, certainly the top 10, I don't know if it's top five, but certainly two of the top 10 players in the league in Caicedo and Palmer. Like that is 2/3 of your midfield is like, genuinely world class.
Like
that goes a long way. And as for Newcastle, I think, yeah, like you get back the left back who was a really important progressive passer for you last season, and you actually have some fullbacks who can run forward, whereas at the moment it's like we've got Dan Burn. Like I like Dan Burn, but he's not the kind of fullback who's like overlapping, is he? So anyway, like I'm positive about United overall at the moment. I do have my concerns about what happens when people adjust to them, because I feel like this year, my opinion of Amorim as a sort of creative tactician who can respond to other teams, like that has really worried me. You know, like the way that there was a long period where teams would press them and they just did the same thing again and again. It was like to the centre back, to Onana, out to the wide centre back, back to Onana. He goes long, they lose the ball. You know, like there was a lot of that. And I was like, a normal manager would do two games of this and be like, man, fuck this, we've got to do something else. And he persisted with it for months.
Yeah,
and so worries me.
Their sixes are the biggest issue here, because I think that is, everything revolves around that. If you want to do plan B, plan C,
sure,
it's difficult to do it if you've got Casemiro and Ugarte as a double pivot.
Sure, but there were teams in the league, like mid-table teams, who also do not have like... Prime Jorginho receiving the ball. Like Palace are using Will Hughes to do that role. Now, don't get me wrong, like it is about profile. And if you don't have that profile in the team, like it doesn't really matter that your player is better than Will Hughes, like if he's just not that kind of player. Like if you don't have a keeper in the squad, it doesn't matter that you're like, hey, we've got like Shushko and he's better than your keeper. It's like not being in goalie, is it?
Yeah.
So I do see that. But at the same time, I kind of think, well, that's where if he'd been a bit more flexible and said, you know what, we're going to play like fucking like 4-4-2, or we're going to play, we're just going to like get a bit, we're going to, or 4-2-2-2 and get a bit more creative. Like, there are ways that you can try and progress the ball when you simply do not have deep passing talent in midfield. And the fact that he didn't find those, it's just
didn't
a
want to. Yeah.
It's just an orange flag.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, okay, what's going on? Anyway, broadly speaking, good, like, positive things for United. And I think Champions League is probably a step too far, but I think in a really, really, really good season where everything broke their way, Europa is possible. It's more likely to end up being Conference. But that's fine. That's okay.
I say Europa is slightly more possible than what you think. But yeah, a Conference is the most likely of the three.
Yeah, I think so. Right, should we move on to the burn book? Right, burn book time. Pete, where do you want to start with the burn book this week?
Okay, I'm going to start, and I am going to put something in the burn book.
Okay.
What I'm going to put in the burn book is chewing gum.
Okay.
I wanted to put in fireworks. We're recording this on Bonfire Night, but I'm fairly certain I did that last year as well, because I fucking hate fireworks.
Yeah,
but
you do hate them.
I'm putting in chewing gum. I'm this is like a twofold one as well. So I'm putting in chewing gum, the product, but I'm also putting in chewing gum, like the act.
Oh, chewing gum and chewing gum.
And I understand that if you remove the product, you remove the act by extension. But I just want to be clear that, like, my issue is with these is both like separate issues. So firstly, the product shouldn't exist. There are, like, the reason it exists is to freshen breath. And
does
the,
it still exist?
Yeah, I do. Well,
as in Emma and I, weirdly, Emma and I literally had this conversation today where we were like, do we think that our girls will ever chew chewing gum? Because I don't know if people do it anymore.
Well, they do. Do you remember
buying like a 10-pack of Juicy Fruit?
Well, see, that's interesting because I do think it still exists. People still have it. I still see it all over. I'm very sensitive to it. And yeah, the reason it exists is to freshen breath. And if the gum that you chew is actually like the Juicy Fruit stuff that is sweet and not minty, then have you considered growing up? Because those are for children. those are sweets, right? It's used to freshen breath. And that desire can be achieved in far more appropriate ways. Like, mints exist. Little travel mints, the tree bore mints, whatever. Even fucking Tic Tacs. Put them in, freshen your breath. They go down your esophagus and into your digestive system. Does the rest. You are your own bin in that scenario.
Are you about to do the, I believe, discredited theory about like chewing gum being in your system for 7 years?
No, but
do you remember that shit?
Yeah. Like, if you swallow chewing gum, it stays with
it. It takes 7 years to go through your system, and you were like,
"So
no,
I'm not
it,
going
no,
to,
it doesn't."
I'm not going to say that, but people don't swallow chewing gum, even though sure. It may or may not stay in your system for 7 years. The relationship with chewing gum and swallowing doesn't exist. People spit it out, and this is part of my issue one of my main issues with the actual product, because one, the half-life of freshness, I believe, is significantly shorter or smaller than that of what you would achieve with like a properly strong mint.
Yes,
so
agreed.
Performance-wise, you're already in the red. And then...
Or those like, you know, the dissolving...
What, the like little strips
tabs
that you put?
That
yeah.
go on your they're like literally made by Listerine. They're disgusting. Yeah, but like you know they're doing something.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas with gum, you get a couple of chews of mintiness, and then it's gone.
And then you've got a problem. I've got a disposal problem.
Exactly, right. So what do? You ball it up in something and set it aside. You spit it in the bottom of a cup. You know, God forbid, put it on the bottom of a table or spit it out on the floor. Mm-hmm. And then somebody walks in it and it, like, the gum just meshes, melds into the crevice, every single crevice of the underside of your shoe, and it's a nightmare to get off. Or you sit on it, and it like welds itself to the fabric, like the seat of your favorite trousers.
Oh, yeah.
Or when I was in a plane a few weeks ago, when we went to Seville, took the in-flight magazine out of the like little pocket in front to see what was on the menu. And a piece of chewing gum had been squashed in to the very bottom, like the underside of the magazine where the pages meet the spine. So it wasn't just one page that was destroyed. It was every single page was affected by it because it was crushed in through the very up into the bottom of the magazine. And I was like, how feral do you have to be?
Yeah, that's very antisocial.
There's nothing positive about the product of chewing gum. It is less efficient than mints, and it causes more issues in like disposing of it. So that shouldn't exist straight up. But what is more annoying to me is the process and the act of chewing gum, like the mastication, the slapping, the squelching of ignorance. Like
it's you look like a cow. You look like a cow when you do it.
It's a type of sound that becomes like truly deafening once you hear it. It's like once you hear it, you cannot hear a single thing until it stops. All you can hear is that chewing. And then there's the worst when people do it with their mouth open as well. Like, I'm big on table manners, chewing with your mouth closed. But for whatever whatever reason, chewing gum seems to bring out the worst in people, and they like open their mouth and really like slap it against, like they really crunch it with.
I think you literally need to pull your jaws because it stretches. I think you literally like have to pull your jaws further apart to achieve separation, and as a result, you look like, you know, they used to shoot those PG Tips adverts with chimpanzees in them.
They would give them like peanut butter.
Yeah, put peanut butter on the roofs of their mouths, and they're just like,
yeah,
yeah.
Witnessing and hearing that whole scenario makes me so immediately infuriated, and I can't deal with it. And we interview like a reasonably senior role in the company a few months ago, and the guy came in. He was probably about 40, chewing gum for the entire job interview.
That's weird.
Chewing gum the entire time, smacking around his lips, smacking around his mouth as he was answering.
I'd be like, have you been in coke all night? Like, why is your jaw rotating in front of me?
And like, as the interview went on, he was still chewing it. The interview was an hour. He chewed it the whole time. And towards the end of it, he blew a fucking bubble.
Okay, was he trying to fuck this
interview?
I have
no idea, but he blew a fucking bubble in the interview with this chewing gum. It wasn't even like bubble gum. It was like white chewing gum. And I think it was just out of like muscle memory. But I was just like, I don't think I listened to a thing he said after like 10 minutes. Because all I was being like, this guy's actually chewing gum in an interview. And then he blew a bubble. And I was like, are you fucking kidding
me? That's mad. You know that as the interviewer, you could say to him, I can't help but notice that you're chewing. Like if a client, I'm thinking about it, if a client came into therapy and was chewing chewing gum. If it was the first session, I think I'd be like, what's going on there? I think I would say,
what's wrong with
you? I don't think I've ever had a client come in and chew chewing gum. Like, what do you think is going on with that? You know, because they might be like, well, I do it all the time, or, you know, I'm giving up smoking or something, you know, I don't know. But if a client came in like now, where the client I've had the fewest sessions with, I've still had like 20 sessions with, you know, we've been together for like nearly 6 months. Mm. Like that client came in and was chewing chewing gum one day, I would say like, why today?
Yeah,
like, but why are you chewing chewing gum today? And in a way, like in the interview, you could be like,
why do you think it's appropriate?
Well, you could say, I think that's a perfectly legitimate question. You'd be like, we are not on the tube. We are not sitting in the bleachers watching the high school football team because we are cheerleaders. Like, this is 2025 and you are, and at your big age, I'm not sure that this is acceptable behavior. Like, this is not, you're not in the cast of Stranger Things. Like, why are you behaving like a preteen?
Also, but this person is trying to sell themselves to us.
Yeah, exactly. Which means that you're entitled to ask.
No, I'm entitled, but I also, if they're going to make themselves look worse, it's not my job to try and like dig them out of their own hole.
Sure, but if he said something
or give them a shovel to dig themselves out.
Sure, but is there absolutely nothing he could have said that might have made you look at it a bit more kindly? I mean, the bubble is pretty strong.
The bubble was mental.
Okay, but that bubble you said was towards the end. But like, if you'd said to him, I can't help but notice that you're chewing chewing gum, which is quite unusual for a job interview. I'm just interested to know like why you've come in here chewing chewing gum today, because it's not the most professional behavior.
Yeah.
And he might have said like, you know, I gave up smoking like a month ago. But I smoke when I'm nervous. I'm nervous about this job interview today. I forgot to take it out before I came in. I came in and suddenly realized it was still in my mouth. And I panicked and I was like, I can't get up and just spit it out. Like, so I'm kind of stuck with it. Like, then you might have been like, okay.
You blew a bubble.
You might not be a cunt. Yeah, sure.
You blew a bubble.
I will say, like I said, all this is PB. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Or pre-B. Like, sure. this does not apply to like post-B. At which point I'd be like, I think we've learned all we're going to learn today. I really wish you said, you just blew a bubble.
Yeah.
And for him to have been like...
I just blew a bubble, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I did.
Yeah.
But with chewing gum, not bubble gum.
Yeah.
So you got to give me credit for that. And you'd be like, I guess I do give you credit.
It was a crap bubble. It was crap.
Sure, but like, I can't blow bubbles with gum. But then I never really chewed enough gum
practice. But also, the quality of bubble is irrelevant. The attempt is the issue.
No, I realize that's the issue, but he could say, but with chewing gum.
Yeah, but he didn't.
So imagine, imagine what I could do on that
with
dick.
Hubba Bubba.
Oh, Jesus. All right. Yeah. Look, I think it's really hard to argue with. Like, it's kind of nice that I was just like, you know what what doesn't happen now? That I interact with chewing gum, you know? And it's still quite shocking if you put your hand on a table and you're like, there's, you know, like if your hands are in your lap and they rub up against the other side of the table and you're like, yeah. Oh God, there's chewing gum there. Like, that's now quite an unusual experience. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But
all right, Lord.
I think that's fine. I'm fine with outlawing it. Okay, what am I putting in the burn book? Okay, mice.
Ooh.
Dog, we got mice in our house.
Plural?
Well, we caught one.
Okay.
And we released it.
Hopefully not back under the house.
Yeah, we released it to a different part of the house. We released it into the nearby park. And
isn't that like, essentially just killing it though? You know?
Yeah. But like, you're not allowed to, but it's considered poor form to kill them. But like, Emma and Coco went and released it. And Coco sometimes is just like, do you think the mouse is still here? And I'm like, that mouse was dead like 30 seconds after you released it. 100% dead.
Yeah.
Like, a dog tore that mouse to pieces. Like, it's fucking dead. But like, these little pricks, there might only be one now, but I suspect not because they breed like motherfuckers. So I'm really hoping we caught the woman. Like, or the man. I don't know. Like, yeah. I don't know what their family set. I don't know what their relationship setups are. But anyway, like, yeah, this little fucker comes out, and it's really funny because like we've got a load of mouse traps out. It's like really not that bad. Like, the mouse is the size.
Little blue ones.
No, you can't buy those anymore. They're illegal. No, they're too.
I thought they were the humane ones.
No, because how could they be humane? The mouse gets stuck in the glue until it dies.
No, I thought you could. I thought there was a way to release it at a point. You like scrape it off. I've never used them before. I just assumed there was a way you could get it out. Otherwise, why wouldn't you just kill it immediately?
I mean, you could euthanize it. You could be like, right, okay, I'm gonna now like submerge this in the bath or something.
Wait, so the point is to catch it and then just starve it?
The glue trap, yeah.
Jesus, right? I thought the whole point with the glue.
The glue trap, they get stuck in the trap and then like they die. Sometimes they die of heart attacks out of stress.
Sure.
You know, but anyway, like, we've got normal traps out that you just like catch them in. And we caught one really quickly, which was pretty good. And it gave us a false sense of confidence. But it's funny because I read all these things online that I'm like, how do you catch these fucking cunt mice? And like, they're all like, well, mice are very timid and they stay very close to the walls. And I'm like, do they fuck? Like, this mouse thinks he owns the place. He comes out to the area where the children's high chairs are, right?
Right,
because no matter how many times you vacuum or whatever, scavenging. You know, you've got a parquet floor, like, there are going to be little areas that, like, you know, little dips in the wood that crumbs can kind of nestle in, I guess. But he goes out, or it just smells of food, I guess. But he goes out to there all the time. And so there are literally like 7 traps there waiting for this little prick. And it's just annoying. I'm like, the other thing is, you can't block up their holes. As in, like, there are areas in the house where we know there are holes and we're blocking those up. But apparently, like, the tip of a ballpoint pen is like a big enough space for a little mouse to squeeze through.
The tip of a ballpoint pen, they're like liquid.
They are tiny. Yeah, they can squeeze through tiny gaps. So you're like, when you look around your house, you're like, I literally can't seal up every hole that's that size. It's not possible. Like, when you have wooden floors, or when you have a fireplace, or we have a cupboard under the stairs, which also, of course, like, has the fuses the water and the gas and everything. And I'm like, there are literally just holes
through the boards
into the ground. Like, what are we going to fucking do? And, we've got a thing in there that grounds the electric supply. Not that old, like 100, 110 years, something
but,
like that.
But that's old enough for there to be a limited amount of like square angles in it as well. Our house is about the same age and it doesn't have a flat floor in it. Or a source, or like a square one.
Oh, no, totally, yeah.
Like, everything's just, like, slightly off because of age, because of how it's, like, developed.
Yeah. There's, like, one side of the room where I'm like, this is, like, we had to properly anchor the shelves to the wall.
Yeah.
Because they were leaning backwards so hard. Yeah, man. So I'm just like, you can't block up all the holes. We're going to do that anyway, because I wanted to do that anyway, just, like, to, you know, basically scrape all the sealant out from between the boards and redo it all.
Yeah.
Just to make the house a bit more, like, to make it hold heat better.
Sure.
But like, we've got fireplaces and all this kind of stuff. And these cunts, like, they can just get through any fucking gap. So I've kind of had enough of having these little traps all over the house.
How long's it been?
Like a month. I'm tired of doing that. And obviously as well, like, Goldie still crawls around on the floor.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, we do have a cleaner now, you know. humble brag, but like we do have a cleaner now, but like, and I like to vacuum. I've got like I've got one of the Dyson rollables and I've got one of the Dyson handhelds, so like I'm happy to vacuum. But no matter how much you vacuum, like double children Dyson. Do just like there is going to be just like mouse shit and piss everywhere, and I just don't want my kids to get.
Do you see a lot of droppings?
Fucking toxoplasmosis? No, not really. Like Emma lifted up the sofa one day because there's definitely a hole in the wall behind the sofa, and she was like, there was a lot of mouse shit under there. Wow. But out in the house, like generally, no, not really. Like I think they literally run out and get food and run back in again, so it's not that bad. Anyway, fuck these pricks. And the next one I find, what's really annoying, okay, is in the evening sometimes I'm sitting on the sofa like watching something with Coco before I take her up for a bath, and I'm sitting on the sofa and I look to my right, you know, where over where the table is and like towards the kitchen, and I see the mouse come out of the cupboard and run over and run back. And I see him do it like honestly 30 to 40 times. Like he was spending 15 minutes doing it, go back and forth. And I'm like, I can see you. There should be something on the market that I can shoot you with. As in, I'm like, I don't need a gun, but there should be like, you know, one of those guns
like
that
an
has
airsoft gun.
One of the guns that has a net in it, you know, or something. I'm like, I should be able to. Like, as in, if you're in
cartoon.
Front of me...
This is pure Tom and Jerry shit.
But
right
you
now.
Know what I'm saying? When I look at a mouse and I'm like, he's 15 feet away.
Yeah.
And I'm like powerless to do anything here. That's so frustrating. And I'm just like, I need to work out a weapon that I can throw at him. And I wonder if it is like a Nerf gun or something. Because so long as it like stuns him / kills him, then I can get rid of him.
Yeah. I mean,
I see him all the time. I see him all the time. The alternative is that I... Maybe not though for a little mouse. But... The alternative is I just wait on the stairs, and when he comes out, I like drop something on him.
So
but he would have to. But I wouldn't be able to drop something that would catch him. I'd have to drop something that would kill him, and I don't really want to do that. And also, like, it would damage my wooden floors.
Yeah,
I don't want to do that.
I remember in like I was maybe five.
Maybe a football would just do it. That would kill him.
8 or 9 years old. There was a mouse in our house. My dad used a colander to trap it.
Okay,
and then took it out to the garage. Put a kitchen towel over its head and hit it with a hockey stick. and that was the end of that mouse.
What he should have done is taken it out to the garage, put on the car, turn the car on, like held the colander up to the exhaust.
Yeah, or like run a pipe from the exhaust into the through one of the holes
exactly.
of the colander.
Yeah, like he like the mouse had just lost his job.
But yeah, but that was the night. That was the mid-90s when, there was only one type of mousetrap, and it was like, it was a spring mousetrap, that was it.
Somebody told me they just like illegally ordered some of the glue traps.
Right.
And I was like, man, I said to Emma, I was like, I'm getting to the point where like, I would do that. And if there's a way to then release.
Can you not do the old school? Can you not get the spring ones anymore either?
Yeah, but why is that better than the other one?
Because like, it kills them quicker.
Yeah, but they've still got to do it. Like, I mean, as in like. The issue isn't we're catching them, but how do we dispose of them? The issue is we're not catching these fuckers. Like, and they're really, whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But like, but I'm considering now, like, because I know the routes the mouse runs, I'm like, well, a glue trap is good because like you can literally put the glue on their routes. Like if the trap's there, they might go round it. But if glue's there, they'll just run over it. And like, then they get stuck. So if there's a way to do the glue and then I could like release them humanely, I would do it. But I said to Emma, I was like, I'm approaching the point where like, I'm making my own fucking glue traps. Like, I'm gonna put out cardboard.
Month-long feud.
I'm gonna put glue on it or bleach, and I'm gonna kill these fuckers. Or I said to her, I was like, next door neighbor, they have a cat. I might just be like, can we borrow your cat?
Yeah.
Can we borrow your cat for one night? He can eat like 6 mice. We'll leave their bodies out. Let that be a lesson.
Heads on sticks. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So mice, bit of an issue for me. What are you taking out of the burn book?
What I'm taking out of the burn book, this one can be quick because it's still a bit of a work in progress for me, but I am going to take growing your hair out of the burn book. So I've been growing my hair out.
I'm doing this as well.
For the past few months. I'm looking to get it a bit longer, a bit like flowier, using my natural wave more than I've ever done before.
Do you have a goal in mind?
No.
Yes.
So I think I'm just going to... Because I think this
Brad
is kind
Pitt,
of...
Legends of the Fall.
It's kind of like the gym thing, right? When you start out going lifting weights
and
you have a body composition, muscle mass in mind, and the closer you get to that, your perspective then shifts bigger and more muscly. So you never, it's like a perpetual carrot dangling in front of you. I feel that this is going to kind of be the same way with the hair. There isn't an end goal in particular, but just like longer, flowier, kind of the more modern slick back stuff, but not like greasy slick back.
The messy slick back.
I feel we'll get to a stage where I'm like, okay, I'm kind of happy with where it is now. But no, there isn't a specific like end goal at the minute. We're just going to see how it is. But historically, my hair has always been, like, my hair's always been good, in my opinion. But it was historically been done with like military precision. And it's been quite a bit shorter. But it's always been like perfectly done, and it will stay perfectly done. And I've been very keen on making sure that it is perfectly done. I just got tired of that. And also I feel that you can quite easily, and I quite easily, or I quite a lot of time, tip too far into the perfect. And then it just look too overproduced, too trying too hard. And it was a weird kind of grass is greener thing where I've got really thick, wavy hair. And for decades, I was like, I wish my hair was thinner and straighter because it would just be easier to manage. And obviously now I'm like, well, no, actually having thick, wavy hair is way more interesting and you can do way more things with it. I think that the kind of culture around men's hair now has also evolved, particularly from, like 10 years ago. Like back in the FD days, every single man in Britain had a mid-fade. Every single one. It was like we were all fucking just came back from being conscripted to the military. And one of the hairstyles was just skin fade. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with a skin fade, but the issue is that when every single person has one, it's just quite boring. Whereas now you're seeing like mullets and perms and like crew cuts with like loads of texture in them. You're seeing lots of guys growing a lot of longer hair again. Hair that we kind of see late 80s, early 90s kind of hair. Like before you got all like the bleach tips and stuff. But I think it's way more interesting. And I also feel that because I'm like, part of the reason was because I got a lot of friends in, well, I don't have a lot of friends. I've got a handful of friends because I'm in my mid-30s. But the important part of that sentence is that I'm in my mid-30s and I'm seeing a lot of guys who I grew up with. And I'm like, holy shit, your hair is just fucking gone. Like you've either shaved your head or you're like really clinging on. And you see them, you might go 6 months without seeing them and you see them again and you're like, ho, it's gotten worse. And it's a real exponential curve that they're suffering. So I feel as somebody whose hairline is pretty similar to what it was 5-10 years ago, and my hair's thick and grows and is wavy, it's almost like it's my duty to all of the mid-30s men for me to grow my hair out. Because, you know, I've got it at this stage. I kind of feel I need to do it. Also, I've never grown it out enough to know what it's like when it's like overall long. I've done it long when when the undercut was a thing. I did that quite long, but that's basically just a long fringe. I don't know about the sides and stuff. So I'm interested to see what happens there on the back. I'm interested to see what happens there. But yeah, it's like I hear a lot of guys start growing their hair out and then get a haircut and cut it short just as it's getting to the right length. Like they give up just before it gets to the right length. And I'm really going to try not to do that.
I think short hair and long hair are both quite low maintenance.
Yeah.
The hair in between is the one that's like a lot of work. And you do tend to give up because you're like, it looks shit. I mean, I think you've just got to get regular cuts, right? Like I went to get this cut last time and I was like, I've been growing it out, but I'm just losing patience. And this guy was like, well, I can like neaten it up, but leave it on top so it's still growing out and we can see where we end up. Because basically he was like, your hair is so thick and wavy that like it needs to get heavy so that it will like actually lie back.
Contain itself,
Yeah, exactly. And he was like, look, you know, like in some places as well, like he was like, you've got quite a strong crown. So there are other places where it like grows forward rather than like back.
So pushes everything up basically.
Because I said to him, I was like, I don't know if it's ever going to work for me if I want to do like a messy slick back, which is kind of what I was thinking. And he was like, maybe it won't, but like I can cut it this time so that it grows. And then like in 5 weeks, we'll have a look at it and see where we are. See, growing long hair in your mid 30s is a flex, but there are two other flexes that I like and consider. One is I'm like buzz cut. Because when someone buzzes their hair, you can see how thin it is in certain places. And so I kind of want to get a buzz cut so somebody can look at it and be like, wow, it's not thin at all.
Yeah, everywhere it's good.
Yeah, that feels, I think that's, and also like, I've got so much hair that I just don't even care. I just buzz it off. The other thing that I find very fun around a group of like men of my age is to be wearing a baseball cap and then remove it. And I feel like they're expecting to see the bald spot that I've concealed. And what's underneath it? Thick, lustrous hair. That's what's underneath it, bitch. But yeah, like I'm glad that you're growing it out because like your hair has quite a lot of different colors in it and it is wavy. And so I think that hair lends itself quite well to a longer look, but it does require discipline because you do just wake up some days and you're like, get this fucking hair off my head.
But at the same time, like, I've had 20 years of being very disciplined with my hair. Like, my hair routine's never been not extensive. So this isn't new. It's actually easier now than it was back then because you can have it messier.
You do, however, have ADHD. And I'm like, do you never get like the impulsive urge to like rip it all off?
No, I've never. So one of the biggest things, probably the biggest thing, is stopping me from shaving my head is face shape. And
you don't have to shave it, but I mean like just cutting it short, like cutting it back to where it was.
Oh, as in like to like go back
giving
to,
yeah to, like older, do you like, have quick. You never in this process of growing it out been like, oh my fucking god, when will it end? Because it takes so much longer than you think.
But I still think it takes less time than what it did before.
Okay.
Because it's never been short, and I'll never buzz it because I don't have the jawline and I can't grow a beard.
How long is it now? Show me now.
It got cut yesterday. It's going to be messy, but...
It's pretty long, man.
Like, yeah. I can put the fringe in my mouth.
Man, that's nuts.
Yeah.
God damn, you're like an e-boy.
But yeah. We're going to see where it goes. And
a lot of volume.
And so it literally got cut last night. And then like the barbers never style it the way you used to do it, the way you can style it. So
they always do it weird.
They always do it horribly. And then like, I literally just came straight home, had dinner, did a bit of prep for the pod and went to bed. So like this is, and then I work from home today. So this is the kind of manifestation of all of that. But yeah, I want to see where it goes. I'm interested. I know what the top looks like because I've done that before. As an undercut, and then just like straighten the hell out of it so that it kind of sat perfectly.
Sure.
But I'm interested to see the sides and the back and just get it like more flowy.
Well, I'm interested to see its final form. Like our wives have been trying to arrange for us to meet, and my wife told me today that she was like, I literally think the first time we might align might be January. And I was like, fucking hell, really?
Yeah.
So we'll see where your hair is at that point. Hopefully I'll see you before that. But like, I'm up for this. I agree. I also think that like when you get older, you're like in your 20s, you sometimes get keyed into that thing where you're like, if my hair deviates too much from like the way I think it should be, it will be a calamity. And to be honest, I think FD, like I don't really remember ever getting shit at FD, but FD was exactly the kind of office where someone would walk in with like a new haircut and everyone would be like, oh, here he is, like look at this fucking guy, you know, like that, oh, you got a job interview, that kind of shit.
There was one famous haircut.
Yeah, there was at least one famous haircut, but I'd say there's more than one.
But also, see, even in that era, we all went to Champs around the corner and all got the same haircut. It was like...
I went to Champs like twice. I hated it.
But everybody else in the office, myself included, every single person went there, bar maybe you and George Wright. Everybody, and probably...
Yeah.
Everybody went there. Everybody got a mid-fade from the same barber. Like, it was basically we all walked in and picked off the set menu for haircuts.
Yeah. And they just ignore you.
Yeah.
They're like incredibly rude to you, like bash out a haircut. Like sometimes it's good, depends how hungry they are. Like, matter of fact, that place. But like, I don't know. Like, now that I'm kind of in my mid-30s, I am just a bit like, would it be so bad if I just, like, when I talk about buzzing my hair off, like, people are always just like, oh, you know, it doesn't always look good. And I'm like, but I don't care if it looks good exactly.
You just
like,
want to know?
I'm just like, I'm intrigued to try it. Like, and then just like, if it doesn't look good, I'll grow it out. And actually a buzz back to normal length is genuinely like a 2 month job.
Oh, so what I've seen with people who have buzzed their hair down to like a pretty low buzz where you have just like literally like kind of like a jar head buzz cut.
Yeah.
When I see after a while, when I see pictures of them with hair, I'm like, oh, you look weird with hair.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
And it's not like you look better with hair. I often think they look worse with hair.
Sure, but I'm just intrigued to do it. Like, I think it'd be kind of fun. It would also probably require me to grow my beard out more because I think you need to balance it. But I think when you get the buzz cut where they really line up like your hairline, I think looks fucking terrible. But the buzz cut where they leave your hairline like natural and then you get a fade on the sides,
yeah,
I think is pretty good.
Yeah,
I think that's it. But anyway, I mean, I think I'll probably do it at some point, you know. But last thing, burn book. What am I taking out of the burn book? Bro, Lily Allen has a new album.
And a lot going on.
She does have a lot going on. I'm not like a huge Lily Allen like fan musically. right? You know, like, I got nothing against her. I did kind of hate the mid-2000s thing of, like, people singing in really fucking English accents.
Yeah.
You know, like her and Kate Nash and shit. And I've been doing impressions of it all week to Emma. I was like, this is kind of like, you're kind of a race traitor, you know?
A race, like, traitor.
Yeah, because you're like, you're kind of doing a pastiche of your culture to make Americans laugh. So it'd be like, oh, you were watching the telly, David Beckham took a free kick, and I said, I'm going to go down Tesco's and buy a sausage roll. Like, you know, it's like a cartoon of, like, English life.
Was Lily Allen the one was like, you got sick of my trainers or something? That was Lily Allen, wasn't it?
I don't know. Her or Kate Nash, one of them.
Yeah.
But I really objected to the period of people singing in really strong English accents, because they didn't just sing in their normal accent.
Kate Nash Foundations. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That is the worst song of all time. Like, that's where she says, like, because you are so bitter.
Yeah.
Like,
in it. Because your mates are much, like, fitter.
Fitter.
With, like, F-I-T-T-A-H.
Fucking moron. Terrible song. Anyway, like, so I kind of hated this.
Yeah.
But Lily Allen has recently produced an album for people who don't give a fuck about her music, but love gossip, which is exactly who I am. And the great thing about it, Pete, this album, is you don't need to know anything about her life to enjoy, because she basically gives you an explainer. Like, so she's just like her songs are written in this, like, very straightforward storytelling way. And so, like, genuinely, some of the songs she's just like, yeah, I went through your phone and I found that you were texting this girl, and I was like, who the fuck is Madeline? And then, like, literally the next song on the, and like the song ends with her being like, who the fuck is Madeline? And then the next song on the album is called Madeline. It's all about this girl, Madeline. And it ends with a reading of the message that this girl that her husband cheated on her with sent her, saying like, I understand you have an open marriage, but I know you have rules. Like, I don't know if we've, like, broken the rules. Please let me know. And it's, like, so fucking obnoxious, but she's, like, trying to be a girl's girl. It's very funny.
Yeah.
And the whole album is like this. And it's like, Lily Allen was married to David Harbour, the actor from Stranger Things, right? Who is notoriously a bit of a wrong'un. Famously a bit of a fucked up guy. In fact, I think there was a thing recently where, like, Millie Bobby Brown has, like lodged an official complaint during filming of, like, Stranger Things, because she supposedly, like, not anything sexual apparently, but, like, bullying. And I was man, like, so I think he is famously a bit of a cock. And there's this story that went around a couple of years ago about some girl who was, like, messaging him online. He, like, flew her out to Vegas and treated her like shit. But anyway, like, this Lily Allen album is, like, truly, I think, really entertaining to listen to, because, like I say, it just guides you through the breakup of her marriage with this guy. She tells you everything that happened. It's incredibly confessional. I also think with Lily Allen, like, you don't need to see... She's not like fucking Taylor Swift, who is like, I must be the perfect victim. Like, Taylor Swift, honestly, one of the most obnoxious things about her musical career is that she's always like the victim. Like, all her songs are about how everyone's fucking wronged her. She's like, Hollywood hates me and my boyfriend was mean to me and you were 30 and I was 21 and I can't believe you dated me. It's like, well, you're an adult. Like, you fucking dimwit, shut up. All her songs basically amount to, like, somebody was nasty to me and I didn't like it and I'm tall and white. Why aren't people kind? Like, whereas, like, with Lily Allen, I'm like, I kind of know that Lily Allen's a bit of a cock as well. So I don't need to be invested in her as, like, the perfect victim.
Yeah.
I don't need to take sides at all.
You don't need to be in her side. Sense. Yeah, like,
exactly.
Just, I could just it's just voyeuristic.
It's pure voyeurism, exactly. And I love it, man. So I've listened to this album a couple of... It's also, like, catchy enough. You know, it's, like, catchy. It genuinely is, like, it's very entertaining to listen to. So I do recommend that you, like, listen to some of these songs, because I was just listening to them like, man, this is fucking crazy.
Is this a record... one of the rare records that you need to listen to in order, or can you shuffle it?
I think you should listen to it in order. If you're like, just because, you know, I mean, unless you really like the album, you want to listen to it.
The good thing is, because I think we've spoken about whenever we did the, like, music, the, like, our five best albums of all time, we're like, the album's kind of dead because nobody listens to the album track one to track 14 or whatever it is anymore. Whereas Lily Allen's kind of forcing her hand here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like a concept album, but for the concept of your husband being a prick.
Being a fucking bellend.
Like, so it's perfect.
An absolute sex pest.
Yeah, so it's not like, oh, it's a concept album for like, oh, what if we were like Bauhaus Architects or something? You know, it's like,
What if my husband just wanted to shag prostitutes?
She genuinely is like, you know, like it's called West End Girl, I think, the album. And she's just like, I'm from London. You convinced me to move to New York. Like, you were like, look at this crazy house, like on this really nice street. Let's just buy it. And you convinced me to do it. Then we moved in. You just started fucking everything that moved. You're an absolute dickhead. Like, it's just fucking funny. Like, yeah. And I do think it is a funny album as well. Like, it's not all just like, oh, I'm so sad now. Though there is that stuff on it, but it's not like a, like you can enjoy it without feeling like a knob. Like, I think she has tried to make an enjoyable album.
It's not like
you're laughing at her misery.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, fuck. What's the German word for that?
Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude. Yeah. Taking
but
joy of someone else's misery. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's good fun. So I recommend it. And on that note, Birnbach over. Show over. We'll meet a bunch of you over on the paid side. Thank you to everybody who's signed up recently. As some of you will have seen, I've kind of finally sorted out the Spotify feeds and everything. So like, if you're, as I said, I think I said this last time, but like, if you're on Spotify now, you will see the paid episodes there. And if you want to sign up to Patreon, you can just click through, it will take you to Patreon. All you do is link your account and you'll get access to the paid episodes. Look, as some of our listeners occasionally sign off in their messages to us, stay toxic, everyone. Love you all. See you later. Bye.